situation that risks turning into famine if the international community does not act urgently. They say the only solution is to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The UK government came under immense fire today after MPs condemned the catastrophic British failures in Afghanistan. During Wednesday's parliamentary debate on the subject, Boris Johnson desperately attempted to convince MPs that Britain's withdrawal wasn't chaotic at all, but with little success.
Mr. Speaker, I think it would be fair to say that the events in Afghanistan have unfolded and the collapse has been faster than I think even the Taliban themselves predicted. What is not true is to say that the UK government was unprepared or did not foresee this.
Before the debate even started, anti-war Labour MPs gathered outside Westminster with anti-war veteran Jeremy Corbyn to denounce British foreign policy.
Many of the MPs who have been supportive of the continued war and occupation in Afghanistan will be sitting today during this debate, which has already begun. Now, this will be very awkward for them, as many of the anti-war MPs who have criticised British foreign policy, particularly in Afghanistan for many, many years, have been proven right following the latest developments in Afghanistan.
British military failures was not the only focus of criticism. Concern over the lack of willingness to help Afghan refugees was expressed too. For the time being, the UK is refusing to recognise the Taliban's administration, but have agreed to accept some refugees, but only time will tell if Britain will honour this pledge or not. Robert Carter, London.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and German Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks in the Kremlin. This is their last summit meeting as heads of state because Merkel will not participate in the upcoming parliamentary elections in Germany. Her farewell visit took place on the anniversary of the alleged poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
Despite the fact that we have different opinions, I think it is good that we talk to each other and we intend to keep in touch further.
After the meeting with the Russian President, Merkel called on Putin to release Navalny. Putin, however, said the fight against corruption should not be used as an instrument of political struggle, adding the opposition figure was convicted not for his political activities, but for criminal offenses against foreign partners. The two also touched upon the situation in Afghanistan. Putin said Moscow's priority is to prevent terrorists from entering neighboring countries under the guise of refugees.
We know Afghanistan, and we know how this country is organized and how counterproductive it is to try to impose unusual forms of government and public life on it. Any such socio-political experiments have never been successful and led only to the destruction of states, degradation of their political and social systems.
In addition to bilateral relations, the fight against the coronavirus pandemic, the conflict in eastern Ukraine, the situation in Belarus, as well as Nord Stream 2 and the role of Ukraine as a transit country for Russian gas were discussed.
Merkel managed to defend the Nord Stream. The Americans pressed on her. Germany needs Russian energy. Regarding the situation in Afghanistan, here Germany fully listened to what the Americans were saying, and now Germany has received it in full. The Americans are living in an ugly way, having substituted all their allies in the NATO alliance. This once again showed that Germans that it's absurd to rely on the US. America's visit shows that the stake on in America is doubtless wrong, and Germany during the reign of Merkel has repeatedly succumbed to influence from overseas.
On August 22nd, Merkel will fly to Kyiv. Putin asked her to influence the country's authorities to fulfill all obligations on Donbass. Berlin has always been one of Moscow's main partners in politics and economics. The Russian president expressed hope that with the new leadership in Germany, in the near future, it would be possible to continue the dialogue on resolving the conflict in southeastern Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish foreign minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country, with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
If an audio clip posted online, Amir Khan Muttaqi, the chief of the Taliban's guidance council, described U.S. actions in Afghanistan as tyranny. He said all Afghanistan is secure, but the airport, which is managed by the Americans, has anarchy. We now present you an article written by Peter Beaumont. The piece is titled, Opposition Leader Says Afghan Civil War Unavoidable If Taliban Refuse Talks. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. One of the main figures still leading Afghan opposition to the Taliban's takeover of the country, Ahmad Massoud, has warned that a new civil war is inevitable without a comprehensive power-sharing agreement in Afghanistan. Ahmad Massoud, the son of Ahmad Shah Massoud, who opposed the Taliban in the 1990s and was assassinated 2 days before suspicious 9/11 events in 2001, told the Dubai-based Al Arabiya television channel that war was unavoidable if the Taliban refused dialogue. He said, "We confronted the Soviet Union and we will be able to confront the Taliban." Massoud, who is the leader of the National Resistance Front of Afghanistan, has set up base in the Panjshir Valley, north of Kabul, where the former vice president, Amrullah Saleh, has also taken refuge. The Taliban said on Sunday, 22nd of August, that hundreds of its militants were heading to the Panjshir Valley to control it after local state officials refused to hand it over peacefully. Massoud's warning was delivered as the Taliban moved to demonstrate its controlled areas immediately around the chaotic Kabul airport, when NATO said 20 people died in recent days. As witnesses reported on Sunday, 22nd of August, that Taliban militants were firing into the air and using batons to force people to form orderly queues outside the main gates and not gather at the perimeter of the airport. The militant group that retook the Afghan capital recently after 20 years said it was seeking complete clarity on the evacuation plan being led by foreign forces. However, it was not clear if the Taliban's increasingly organized presence around the airport would also result in it controlling who is able to enter the airport and leave the country, as the group's spokespeople used the situation at the airport to criticize the United States. Britain's Armed Forces Minister James Hippie said the flow outside the airport had improved because the Taliban were marshalling people into separate queues for the United States and the United Kingdom evacuation. And that is making a big difference to the size of the crowds outside the UK gate and allowing us to process people much more quickly. I think that is very encouraging. In an audio clip posted online, Amir Khan Muttaqi, the chief of the Taliban's guidance council, described U.S. actions in Afghanistan as tyranny. He said, all of Afghanistan is secure, but the airport, which is managed by the Americans, has anarchy. He added, the U.S. should not defame itself, should not embarrass itself to the world, and should not give this mentality to our people that the Taliban are a kind of enemy. The Taliban's remarks emerged as Joe Biden activated the U.S. Civil Reserve Air Fleet, ordering aircraft from six commercial carriers into service to clear the backlog of evacuees arriving in locations outside Afghanistan. Facing mounting criticism over his handling of the Afghanistan crisis, the U.S. president, who has defended his decisions, was due to speak again to give an update on the evacuation efforts in Kabul. Earlier on Sunday, an NBC News opinion poll showed his job approval rating had dipped below 50% for the first time. Biden administration officials also claimed on Sunday, 22nd of August, that they were considering the so-called creative ways to get Americans and others into Kabul airport. As Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced, he had called a G7 leaders meeting to discuss the crisis in Afghanistan and urged the international community to find ways to prevent it from escalating. The deaths outside of Kabul airport have come as a new perceived threat from the militant group in Afghanistan has led U.S. military planes to perform rapid diving combat landings at the airport, which is surrounded by Taliban militants. Other aircraft have fired flares on takeoff, a tactic often used to confuse possible heat-seeking missiles targeting the planes. A NATO official also appeared to concede the risks in the Taliban's increased assertion of control beyond the airport's perimeter, saying, our forces are maintaining strict distance from outer areas of the Kabul airport to prevent any clashes with the Taliban. A journalist on board an evacuation convoy that left the downtown Kabul hotel early on Sunday, 22nd of August, told Agence France-Presse that a huge crowd of Afghans were camped at the intersection close to the airport, many sleeping in the open, who crowded the buses with their documents asking to be let on. Families hoping to escape were crowded between the barbed wire boundaries of an unofficial no man's land separating Taliban militants from U.S. troops and the remnants of an Afghan Special Forces brigade helping them. He said, as soon as they saw our convoy, they got up and ran towards the buses. with the Taliban moving to assert its control over the country a week after seizing power, the group called for the reopening of schools and colleges and said it would meet provincial governors across the country. A Taliban official who spoke on the condition of anonymity said, "We're not forcing any former government official to join or prove their allegiance to us. They have a right to leave the country if they would like to." He added, "We're seeking complete clarity on foreign forces' exit plan," adding, "Managing chaos outside Kabul airport is a complex task." The UK Ministry of Defence, the MOD, said conditions on the ground remained extremely challenging, but it claimed we are doing everything we can to manage the situation as safely and securely as possible. The evacuation of foreigners and Afghans linked to foreign countries remained fraught on Sunday, 22nd of August, after the United States and Germany warned citizens to avoid traveling to Kabul airport, citing security risks including from thousands of desperate people gathering trying to flee from the Taliban and Daesh. The Taliban's swift takeover of Afghanistan has sparked fears of reprisals and a return to the harsh version of tough law that the militant group exercised when it was in power two decades ago. However, Taliban officials have blamed the anarchy at Kabul airport on U.S. occupation forces, whilst U.S.-led forces have blamed the militant group for blocking many from reaching the airport.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The evacuation of Kabul International Airport is ongoing, and so has the mayhem. This has forced the U.S. president to announce that it may want to extend the U.S. military presence at the airport until all who want to leave the country can actually depart successfully. Meanwhile, the Taliban has rejected that and has said that it will not form a government until all foreign and U.S. forces leave Afghanistan. Is the Taliban ready to form a government, and what will it do about the resistance stronghold of Panjshir? Just some of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. But first, to get an update, Amin Alami is a correspondent joining us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Lots to cover in a short period of time. Give us the latest that you can, Amin.
Well, Kaba, despite American sources here in Kabul say that the situation is under their control in Kabul International Airport, but Taliban authorities say that the American troops have failed to bring the situation under their control in order to prevent the ongoing chaos in the Kabul International Airport. For instance, we can say that at least seven individuals, including an Afghan soldier, were killed as a result of chaos and gunfire inside the Kabul International Airport. In the meantime, there are hundreds of Taliban members who are guarding the entrance gates of Kabul International Airport, preventing the people from entering this area, as well as there are also thousands of foreign troops, mainly American forces, UK troops, French soldiers, and as well as other foreign national military forces who are working to evacuate their own nationals as well as Afghan nationals who have worked with them. In the meantime, the Taliban are also very busy, not only with the chaos and the in Kabul International Airport and the rest of issues here in the Afghan capital Kabul, mainly when it comes to governance issues, but they are currently they have currently surrounded Panjshir Valley or Panjshir Province and north east of Kabul. Ahmed Massoud, who is the son of the Afghan legendary commander Ahmed Shah Massoud, is there, and he says that I will resist against the Taliban if they refuse to accept the establishment of an inclusive government that must address the need of the people of Afghanistan and that must respect many other issues such as human rights and democratic values. In the meantime, political consultations and meetings are also underway here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, between Taliban leadership and some prominent political leaders, including some former Afghan government officials. For instance, Abdullah Abdullah, who was the head of Afghan Reconciliation Council, recently met with a high number of Taliban leaders. Hamid Karzai is another key figure who was the former Afghan president. He has also met with top political leaders, as well as Hikmatyar has done so. These moves show that the Taliban are strongly after gaining control, politically gaining control over Afghanistan via gaining legitimacy, first inside Afghanistan, right, and second, they are after gaining regional and international legitimacy. That is why we see that there are some reactions by regional powers and international countries, for instance, Iran, Russia, France, and UK. All of them has had their own viewpoint or stance regarding to the ongoing situation in Afghanistan. For instance, Russia says that Moscow is not concerned or worried about the ongoing situation in Afghanistan, particularly the rule of Taliban over Kabul, because as the Russian foreign minister recently said, the Taliban has proved to be committed to most of their commitments. So this shows that the situation is going to be more complex in Afghanistan. That is why top politicians inside Afghanistan are also calling on the Taliban and the rest of players inside this country to urgently find a solution to put an end to the ongoing situation and a situation that is called vacuum of power in Afghanistan in order to see a stable Afghanistan. But in the meantime, people are worried, not only here in Kabul, but across Afghanistan. Millions of people have so far been displaced, and hundreds of thousands of them have so far been left the country. The leaving of Afghanistan by its residents are continuing. That is why the Taliban are also trying to prevent the people from leaving Afghanistan behind, because they say that we are here to bring peace, security, and create jobs for Afghans. But as you see and as we saw on the streets of Kabul here, there are less presence of women here, and it proves that the Taliban needs to work further to prove that they are committed, especially when it comes to their promises.
Thank you very much for that. I mean, Alami, we do appreciate it. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight, Professor of History at James Madison University, Shah Mahmood Hanifi, who joins us from Washington, D.C. An author and academic and an expert on Afghanistan, Muhammad Daoud Meraki, who joins us from Chicago.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both, and let me start with you, Shah Mahmoud Hanifi, if I may, from Washington, D.C. I don't want to reiterate or repeat something that's been going on in the past days, and that is this messy evacuation that's taking place at Kabul International Airport. When you take a look at what's really going down here, when the U.S. has to have the Pentagon come out and brief reporters and the world daily, every day, as to what's going on there, tell us what that really reflects and what that really shows. Because some are saying that shows how unorganized Afghanistan was in terms of the way that it was executed based on the occupation that took place. And others are saying that, this is a negative reflection on America's waning power. How do you see it?
Well, I think both of those viewpoints carry some legitimacy. The president's need to speak to the American public reflects, I think, a number of interest groups in the American political space, particularly veterans who are quite prominent and animated about maintaining, I guess, some ethics of comradeship in war, or something that necessitates ultimately or justifies the situation in Kabul at the airport. And that situation, to me, is the result of something that must have had some management to it. And I'm not sure about the particular players, but Dangmei Khayyumzad would seem to have a role in the bloodless, really very few shots fired in Kabul or elsewhere when the Taliban gained control of the capital. It's quite how that happened is, I think, not accidental, but that the result of the Taliban and Ghani's flight resulted in this situation at the airport that I think involved both very public American statements by the president and very clear visible actions at the airport, but the American empire has been working at a public level, such as we just addressed, while at the same time working at a covert level that we just do not know precisely what communications with the Taliban and other actors, what extractive techniques by helicopter from the Baron Hotel, for example, recently, is going on. Uh-huh. So I think as always with the American political arena, there is so much that the American public is not aware of and that the government won't speak to because of securitization and sequestration of information.
Sure. Well, when you want to take a look at the response over here, Mohammad Dawood Meraki, the Taliban has said that they're not going to abide or listen to the Americans to have an extension beyond that August 31st deadline, in which the U.S. president at this point is contemplating it. Do you think that the Taliban, and they've actually warned the U.S. on this, do you think the Taliban is going to follow up on the threats of the U.S. delayed departure, if you want to call it, from the country?
It's a complicated situation that we have at hand here. You see, we need to look back at what the United States had done post the Doha agreement. And they had agreement that they will not violate such and such and such, whatever they agreed upon. But toward the end, before the victory in Kabul, the United States military has violated that agreement more than 800 times. The Taliban a few times has been observed by others as well. Taliban, trying to use rational thinking for the most part here. they realize that Americans have departed and they have no way of remaining in the country, and they got defeated, whether somebody accepted or not. But they don't want to complicate the situation. They don't want to exacerbate the already complicated situation and add to the animosity and to the onset of conflict. Their aim is political. Their aim is trying to form a government and get a recognition and have services to the people, to the population, and put an end to this disorder that's been going on in the airport. I must also add that this disorder was created by the United States government as a way, also as a brain drain, if you like. There's been a lot of technical people that have been moving out from here, and they have been reluctant actually to prevent people from entering the airport. They simply mentioned that everybody is welcome as long as they're able to come, and so now people are concerned about leaving the country. You know, remember there was barely any option for them to leave the country. Now they have a free ticket, so to speak, and a lot of technical people are leaving and they're leaving the country. So they created this mess, and the Taliban are waiting, hoping they will put an end to it, and they will fulfill their obligation and leave the country by the 31st of August. Okay. But whether the Taliban will react, it's more a political issue at this point than a military one.
Well, when you take a look at the statements coming from the Taliban, as you said, it sounds like they're coherent, organized. Their approach is such that violence has decreased. But at the same time, there are question marks about whether they're actually going to be able to form a government. You have, on the one hand, if you want to call it a new administration called the Taliban that has to run the economy, but they have their funds frozen by the U.S. Overseas. At the same time, you have this resistance stronghold, Panjshir Valley, that they have to deal with. So they still have to, diffuse that and put that fire out. Do you think they'll be able to do all of this and still be able to govern the country?
You see, first of all, this Panjshir business has been really blown out of proportion. It was a mistake of Taliban to resort to suggestion by others, by elders, to let's not increase this unity and let's symbolically do not attack Panjshir and so forth. He took over all of Afghanistan in a blink of an eye. And then their mistake was they should have, once they took over Badakhshan and Tahar, they should have straight came into Panjshir and cleaned it up. But now the West, they need stooges. You see, the Henry Levy, the Zionist philosopher, he has advocated or popped up this individual Ahmed Massoud in Paris and introduced him to the president of France. Like his father, he is also serving foreign interests. There's nothing legendary about him, about his father. His father was a prophet of the Russians.
Let me jump in here to make sure that we understand you correctly. You're saying that Israel is responsible for some kind of support that he is giving this person from what's called the National Resistance Front, Ahmed Massoud? Did I understand you correctly here?
This Zionist by Henry Levy, his name is, he's from France. He has been involved in most Muslim countries in the conflict and instigates so-called resistance in order to create disorder in Muslim societies. And he has done the same thing back in the 90s. He came to Panjshir doing the same thing, and he's done the same thing this time.
Okay.
The issue is this: the Taliban wanted to avoid bloodshed.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to hold on to your thoughts. Let me bring Shah Mahmoud Hanifi back into the conversation here. So let's look at the international either acceptance or rejection or a state of doubt at this point when it comes to the Taliban. For example, the European Union, it has not recognized the Taliban. The EU Commission President saying that it's not holding political talks with what it calls the militants, and this a week after they seized control of Afghanistan. How do you see the international recognition coming when it comes to the Taliban? Is the Taliban looking for it, or is the Taliban going to be happy with its immediate either acceptance or getting along of its with its neighbors? We can mention Russia, we can mention obviously China, and also Iran, that has asked for a reconciliation to involve all groups within the country in order to, you know, establish peace and security.
Well, you know, again, some of the public recognition by China and by Russia are one thing, but behind the scenes diplomatic maneuvering, Pakistan has not been mentioned. Pakistan's strategic depth has been apparently furthered with the Talib returning to power. And I think the point about American withdrawal is a bit of an overstatement. I don't think the United States will be removing its presence in Afghanistan. Its covert presence, and it does involve intelligence agencies. And in this sense, the international community now has a number of constellations, a group of the European Union for one, but as our previous speaker so helpfully noted, within the European Union, certain countries, in this case France, exert, leverage upon the whole in ways that make potentially France's bilateral perspective on the Taliban broader to include the European Union's, kind of policy position.
Let me bring in the guest then and see if he agrees with you on this, because you mentioned that the U.S. is not going to actually really withdraw, but covertly is going to have a presence. Do you agree with that, Mr. Meraki? Is the U.S., even though it has said it's withdrawn itself, but it's going to have some kind of a presence, which then I ask you, does that mean that directly, it's going to somehow have some kind of contact with the Taliban?
The contact Taliban will have contact with everyone in the world, you know, all the governments. And the U.S., of course, has been asking Pakistan, has been asking Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, as well as Kyrgyzstan and other countries for military base. They are worried, supposedly, this boogeyman they call Al-Qaeda is going to evolve again out of nowhere with supposedly 150-something people in 2001, and then, you know, it's been obviously hatching, exponentially. It's not disappearing, and so their perspective is that they want to be vigilant in the region. And the fact of the matter is, the United States all along was concerned to be present in Afghanistan in order to monitor activity in China and Russia, and also to contain whatever they choose to contain, and also instigate domestic disorders in those societies, contentions that were there, they wanted to manipulate it for their own end.
Okay, I'm going to ask that question. I'm sorry, because we're fresh out of time. In 30 seconds, if you can, Shah Mahmoud Hanifi, will the U.S. continue its cooperation one way or another with the Taliban, perhaps for its own means, such as countering China and maybe even with an eye on Iran?
I believe, again, in some form, yes, the United States will continue to engage who's ever in power in Kabul. And I think the support that the United States may extend to not just Ahmad Shah Massoud, but Saleh, who is there now as well, will remain a conduit of influence in the political equation of Afghanistan.
Unfortunately, I got to jump in. We're just fresh out of time on this. Thank you so much. Let me thank our guest, Professor of History at James Madison University, Shah Mahmoud Hanifi. Thank you. And academic author and expert on Afghanistan, Mohammad Dawood Meraki. And, of course, Manami Nalami at the top of the debate. I'm sorry, at the top of the spotlight. From Bikawa Tawai and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
More Afghan-like tragedies will be inevitable until we squeeze the personal profit out of prepping for war, says Sam Pizzigatti writer in an article titled America's Merchants of Death Then and Now. Stay tuned for more. The 20th century, after all, rates as the deadliest century in human history. Upwards of 75 million people died in the Second World War alone. Millions more have died in little wars since, including the nearly 250,000 who perished during the 20 years of the U.S. military war in and on Afghanistan. But for the forebears back in the early decades of the 20th century, the incredible deadliness of modern warfare came as something of a shock. The carnage of the First World War, with its 40 million dead, left people worldwide searching for new international arrangements that could prevent any repeat of modern war's horror. The Paris Peace Conference of 1919 launched the League of Nations and sparked a series of additional global parleys. The Washington Disarmament Conference of 1922, the Geneva Arms Control Conference of 1925, the Geneva Disarmament Conference of 1927. In 1928, the world's top nations even signed an agreement that renounced war as an instrument of national policy. All these steps would prove hopelessly inadequate to the task at hand. By the mid-1930s, the world was swimming in a weapons of war sea, and people still reeling from the First World War, the Great War, wanted to know why. In the United States, peace seekers would follow the money to find out. Many of America's moguls, they soon realized, were getting ever richer off prepping for war. These merchants of death, the era's strikingly vivid label for war profiteers, had a vested interest in perpetuating the sorts of arms races that make wars more likely. America needed millions of Americans believed to take the profit out of war. On Capitol Hill, the Democratic Senate majority set up a special committee to investigate the munitions industry and named a progressive Republican, North Dakota's Gerald Nye, to chair it. The War and Preparation for War, Nye noted, and a panel's founding in 1934, had precious little to do with either national honor or national defense. War had become a matter of profit
for a few. The tag Merchants of Death has long since disappeared from American political lexicon, but the problem now named remains. Contemporary corporate moguls of the U.S. are continuing to get rich off the preparations that make wars more likely and massively multiply death counts when the actual shooting starts. America's longest war, the war in Afghanistan, offers but the latest example. We won't know for some time the total haul of corporate executive class of the Afghan War's 20 years. But Institute for Policy Studies analysts Brian Wacomo and Sarah Anderson have come up with some initial calculations for three of the top Department of Defense contractors active in Afghanistan over the 2016 to 2020 years. The total compensation for the CEOs at these three corporate giants, Flora, Raytheon, and Boeing, amounted to $236 million. The overall personal haul for U.S. current-day merchants of death from the carnage in Afghanistan? We would need a modern-day special congressional committee to get at that number, partly because many of the enterprises facilitating death and destruction remain privately held and need not release the annual executive pay figures that publicly traded companies must release. A modern-day high-profile panel on war profiteering might not be a bad idea. Congressional members of the panel could start their work by reviewing the 1936 conclusions of the Senate's original Special Committee on Investigation of the Munitions Industry. Munitions companies that committee found have exploited opportunities to intensify the fears of people for their neighbors and have used them to their own profit. They have ignited and exacerbated arms races by constantly striving to scare nations into a continued frantic expenditure for the latest improvements in devices of warfare. Worse, the Senate panel summed up rarely have one single cause, but it runs against the peace of the world for selfishly interested organizations to be left free to goad and frighten nations into military activity. Do these conclusions still hold water for Americans today? A new special committee could ask, and if they do, what can they do to remedy this situation? Some members of the original Senate panel apparently wanted to nationalize what they now call the defense industry. That didn't happen. And today's complex of military contractors dwarfs the size of the Merchants of Death network that Americans faced back in 1930s. The U.S. Pentagon and military Lindsay Kashagarian of the National Priorities Project points out currently take up more than half of the discretionary federal budget each year, and over half that spending goes to military contractors. Most of these contractors, adds Heidi Peltier, the director of the 20 Years of War Initiative at Boston University Perdis Center, essentially operate as monopolies. The excessive profits that the status helps them grab are widening America's core inequality. Lockheed Martin's executive chair, at last count, is making $30.9 million a year. In 2020, executives at Lockheed and four other contracting giants, including Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and General Dynamics, spent $60 million on lobbying to keep their gravy train going. Over the past two decades, the Center for Responsive Politics reports the defense industry as a whole has spent $2.5 billion on lobbying to influence defense policy and directed another $285 million to political candidates friendly to contracting business as usual. how can one upset that business as usual? Reducing the size of the military budget can be a start. Contracting out fewer necessary functions, keeping defense work in-house, and reforming the contracting process itself will also be essential. But executive pay needs to be right at the heart of that reforming. No corporate executives dealing in military matters should have a huge personal stake in ballooning federal spending for war. Current federal government contracting regulations do limit how much executives can grab directly in salary from the cash their companies pocket for contract work. But corporate executives don't particularly mind these limits since they get the overwhelming bulk of their total compensation from their stock-based rewards, not their salaries. Representative Jan Schakowsky and the Congressional Progressive Caucus have a better approach. Their newly proposed Patriotic Corporations Act would, among numerous other promising provisions, give extra points in contract bidding to firms that pay their top executives no more than 100 times what they pay their most typical workers. Few defense giants these days come anywhere close to that 100 times ratio. At Raytheon, for instance, the chief executive last year pulled down 193 times the pay of the company's most typical worker. And that relatively modest gap by U.S. corporate standards came only after the Raytheon CEO took a temporary COVID time pay haircut.